priest of Baal up in Bethel. And one day he went to Jeroboam the king and said, you know, we've got a problem up here. There's a guy up here who is killing us with what he's saying. He's saying that you're going to be killed and that Israel is going to be led off captive. And so Amaziah told that to Jeroboam. Then he went back to Amos and said, listen, you need to get back down to the Bible Belt. We don't want your kind up here in Bethel. We don't care what you have to say. And Amos says, well, I tell you what, I'm not a prophet. I'm not even the son of a prophet. I'm a farm boy. But the Lord told me to come up here and say some things, and I'm here and you're going to hear them. And that's the way the prophets were with people. You know, some of the greatest prophets were not writing prophets or even mentioned in the writing prophets. 1 Kings 22, Micaiah. Jehoshaphat was a good king down in Judah. And he was related by marriage to the worst of kings, Ahab, up there in Israel. And he pays a visit to Samaria to see Ahab one day. And Ahab is planning a campaign against Ramoth Gilead to recapture that city that had been taken by the Syrians. And he's wanting Jehoshaphat to join with him to go up there. And Jehoshaphat says, well, is there not here a prophet of Jehovah that we might inquire of about this campaign? Now, Ahab had 450 priests of Baal. He used to have 850, but Elijah took care of 400 of them. And all of those priests were saying, go up and prosper. And Jehoshaphat had enough sense to know that the priests of Baal were not the ones he was wanting to listen to as far as any advice about a military campaign. And he says, well, no, I mean, is there not here a prophet of Jehovah that we might inquire of about this? And Ahab says, well, there's one man, Micaiah, son of Imlah, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything good about me, only evil. And I tell you what, if I'm on the preacher search committee, that's enough for me to hire Micaiah. I mean, if I'm going to be looking for somebody to come preach for me, I want to know who Ahab hates. And Jehoshaphat says, now don't talk like that, Ahab. Let's bring him in. And so they bring Micaiah in. And Jehoshaphat says, what about it? Shall we, if we go up, how are things going to turn out? And Micaiah says, go up and prosper. He says the same thing the priests of Baal are saying. But as soon as he says it, I mean, you think, has he sold out? Has he been bought out? Has he compromised? As soon as he says it, Ahab says, see, I told you, he never has anything good to say about me. I mean, there must have been something in his expression, something in his tone, that Ahab knows he's not hearing it straight. And so Ahab says, now come on, Micaiah, we want to hear what you have to say. And Micaiah says, okay, in that case, I see Israel as sheep scattered without a shepherd. Ahab, you're going to die. And Ahab got angry and he said, take this guy out of here and lock him up and throw the key away and feed him on bread and water till I come back in peace. And they go up to Ramoth Gilead, and some unknown Syrian archer pulls his bow back and lets fly with his arrow, and it finds a chink in Ahab's armor. And he's taken off the battlefield, and he dies. And so far as I know, Micaiah died in prison on a diet of bread and water. But that's the way the prophets were. And we're talking about the prophets this week, and it's just a pleasure to have you with us. I've got to mention, I've got a special guest here tonight, my friend Doug Danford. Doug and I grew up together. Doug got me in a lot of trouble when I was a kid. He was a bad influence, but I survived. And we had a lot of fun together. I was on a farm, and Doug's dad was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. And there were some families when I was growing up that we transcended just being family, friends. We were family. And that has stayed all through these many years since then. It's just a real pleasure to have Doug. And I think I see the Johns with us tonight. And it's just so good to see them. And if I'm missing anybody I ought to mention, I apologize for that. But if you will, take your Old Testament and turn to the book of Obadiah. We're going to begin our study of love in the prophets by looking at a prophet that's hardly ever studied, and that's Obadiah. And to set the stage for Obadiah, I'll tell you about a story that you know. I know you know it, but I want you to know that I know it. And the story involves a set of twins. And even though they were twins, they could not have been more unlike. The older of the two was a man's man. He was a man of the field. He was favored by his father. The younger was a mama's boy. I tell you, when parents show preference in a family, you're going to have trouble. And that's what went on in Isaac's family. They played favorites, and sometimes they played the favorites against each other. And then there came a day when the younger, true to his name meant cheater. True to his name, the younger scammed, so to speak, the older out of the older's inheritance. Now, the older wasn't innocent in the matter, but the younger took advantage of the older. And when the older realized what had happened, he waited until the father had died. They waited until they'd buried Isaac. But then the older let it be known he was going to kill his brother. Esau was going to kill Jacob. And Jacob, afraid, took off running. And he went north. He went to some relatives up north of the area where they lived in. And he was gone for 20 years. And then when God told Jacob it was time for you and your family to go back to the promised land, Jacob went back, and there was a reconciliation between the two. I mean, there's a great scene in Genesis where Jacob and his family are headed back south, and they hear that Esau, his brother, the last thing he heard from him is, "I'm going to kill you." Esau, with an armed force, is coming out to meet him. And sometime during the night, Jacob, we really don't know what happened, but it almost seems as if he is jumped by somebody, or he is aware of someone's presence, and he wakes up, and there's an individual there, and they get into a wrestling match. And they wrestle all night. And just about the breaking of day, Jacob, he can just barely hold on, and the adversary, maybe he thought it was an assassin sent out by Esau to get him. We don't know, but the adversary of Jacob just touches his hip. He's not worn out to the point where he can't continue the match. He just touches Jacob's hip. It's thrown out of joint, and Jacob is hanging on for dear life. The adversary lets me go, and Jacob says, "No, I'm not going to." And the adversary asks him this question then. He said, "What's your name?" Now, that's a strange question to ask somebody in a wrestling match. "What's your name?" And he says, "My name is Jacob." And the adversary says, "No, not anymore. You've been Jacob. From now on, you're going to be Israel, a prince of God." Now, to understand that scene, you've got to understand, Jacob simply wasn't telling his name, like name, rank, and serial number. He was not telling his name like that. He was confessing. The name Jacob means cheater. It means supplanter. He was fessing up to the kind of person he had been. He had taken advantage of everybody he could take advantage of. And he finally comes clean, admits the kind of person he is, and as soon as he does that, God pronounces a blessing on him. As soon as he admits the kind of person he is, the text says he had power with God. And God pronounced blessing. God doesn't ask a whole lot of us, does he? But one of the things he does ask is that we fess up to who we are. I mean, his name was cheater. We may be liar. We may be immoral. We may be lukewarm. We may be compromiser. You know, whatever we are, God asks us to confess that. And that's when the blessing comes. And so that's the background involving these two boys. And even though there was a reconciliation, when Esau and Jacob finally meet, Esau is so effusive in his demonstration of love for his brother Jacob says, I have seen the face of God. And so even though they have a reconciliation there by the brook Jabbok, there was animosity that continued within their descendants. And the descendants of Esau became the nation, the tribe of Edom, down to the southeast of the Dead Sea. And of course, Jacob's descendants became the Israelites. And in Obadiah, we have a prophet who deals with this business of brotherly love. I'll say more about that when we get toward the end this evening. I said a little bit about it this morning. But I want us to look at the book of Obadiah, and if you want to outline the text we're going to be in, we're going to be in the first 16 verses, and there are just two sections to the first 16 verses. In verses 1 through 9, we're told what's going to happen to Edom. In verses 10 through 16, we're told why it's going to happen. So we've got a what and a why going on here. And read with me, if you will, the first 9 verses, and we'll see exactly what was in store for the descendants of Esau. The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. If thieves come to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes? How are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat the bread have thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Eden, and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off. Now this is a passage of judgment. And when God judges, he can do it in one of two ways. God can judge by intervention, by stepping in and bringing terrible things upon a nation. In 2 Peter chapter 2, when Peter is talking about what happened to the world of Noah and what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, in reference to the world of Noah, Peter says God brought a flood on that world. And the word translated flood is the word cataclysm. But in regard to Sodom and Gomorrah, Peter says God overthrew those cities. The word translated overthrow is the word catastrophe. So God sometimes judges through a cataclysm, turning a world upside down, or through a catastrophe, bringing terrible things upon a nation or a people. And sometimes God judges through non-intervention. Romans chapter 1 is the classic text on that. God gave them up 3 times in reference to the Gentiles. Paul says, God gave them up. He just stepped aside and let them have at it. Sometimes the hardest, harshest judgment God can pronounce on us is to get out of the way and let us do what we're intending to do. Well, with Edom, the descendants of Esau, he's going to intervene. And there are 5 things that God says is coming. In verses 2 to 4, your pride is going to be humbled. Now, verse 3 is topographically accurate. Edom depended on its location. They were there southeast of the Dead Sea in the mountains, narrow defiles, narrow passes. An army could not successfully deploy itself in that area. They had caves up in the mountains. They'd get up there, they'd pull up the ropes so nobody could get to them. They had plenty of supplies. They thought they could last forever. Upon their rock, they built their civilization. And they thought they were like the eagle up there beyond the reach of anybody. But God says, I'm going to bring you down. Listen, folks, when God wants you dead, it doesn't matter how many nuclear weapons you've got. It doesn't matter how many planes, how many ships. It doesn't matter how big your mountains are. When God wants you dead, you're going to end up dead. Ask Ahab. Secondly, in verse 6, God says your wealth is going to be plundered. Edom was on a major trade route. And a lot of commerce went through there, and Edom got very rich in the process. And God says, you're going to be plundered to where there is nothing left. Now, when thieves break in a house, they might take the TV, but they don't take the trash. I mean, they always leave something behind. When you pull into the field with the combine, I mean, I've been in plenty of fields when corn's being picked and beans are being combined, and I can tell you, the farmer doesn't pull out of that field with every ear of corn or every soybean on every plant in that field. There's always grain left behind. But in verse 6, God says, Edom, when I send people in to take care of you, they're not going to leave anything behind. You're going to be picked clean. And then in verse 7, you've made some alliances, haven't you, Edom? I mean, you've got some confederations with area tribes and nations, and they're going to turn on you. In fact, the very first verse of Obadiah is a call to the nations around Edom to turn on Edom. If America ever gets weak enough, one of the first ones who's going to turn on us is going to be NATO. The nations we're now in alliance with, I mean, history will show that to be so. They will turn on us. That's what happened to Edom. That's what happens historically. That's what will happen to America. In verse 8, God says, I'm going to destroy your wisdom. One of Job's best friends was Eliphaz. Eliphaz was from Edom. Eliphaz thought he was a pretty smart guy. He wasn't nearly as smart as he thought he was. He didn't understand God at all. God says, I'm going to destroy the wisdom of Edom. And then in verse 9, your army is going to be destroyed. Your mighty men are going to be slaughtered. When the leaders of the army are not wise, the army isn't going to win. And so God is speaking of total judgment on Edom. Now, you know, Obadiah may have been the first of the writing prophets. When you read the commentaries, there are two dates typically given for the writing of Obadiah. One is in the 9th century B.C., one is in the 6th century B.C. But the date you go with is going to be determined by five things. Number one, Edom is an independent nation. Number two, Jerusalem has been invaded. It's been sacked. Number three, it's going to be Gentiles, not Israel, that invades Jerusalem and causes havoc down there. Number four, there are going to be Jewish captives taken. And then number five, after all of that, Edom is again going to be subjected to Israel, to the Jews. Now, four of those five fit the later date in the 6th century. But all five of them fit the earlier date. And I just tend to think that it's the earlier date that's the right date, and that Obadiah may be the very first of the prophets who wrote. And in this very first prophet, if I'm right about that, God's speaking to a non-Jewish group. But he's speaking to a group that's related to Israel. Moses in Deuteronomy told the Israelites, you're not to abhor the Edomites, they are your brother. And so that is what is going to happen, but why is it going to happen? Let's read verses 10 through 16. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother in the day that he became a stranger, neither shouldst thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, neither shouldst thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. Thou shouldst not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yea, thou shouldst not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. Neither shouldst thou have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. Neither shouldst thou have delivered up those that of his that did remain in the day of distress. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head, for as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. They shall drink, they shall swallow down, they shall be as though they had not been. Five reasons why judgment is coming to Edom. The first, there in verse 11, is that they were guilty of violence against their brother Jacob. But what constituted the violence? Keep reading. In the day that you stood on the other side. In the day that you did nothing. When you didn't come to help. When you just were an observer watching. And you did nothing. In that day, you were guilty of violence. I'm going to tell you, some of the most violent things that can ever be done to you is when a friend, family member, someone you're counting on doesn't come to your side when you need help. And it may be that the reason they don't come to your side is because they think you're getting what you deserve. I mean, you've made your bed and you're going to have to lie in it. God help us that He never take that view toward us. I suspect part of that was involved in Edom, standing on the other side. I mean, the priest and the Levite, they just didn't pass by on the other side. They committed violence against the Samaritan in passing by on the other side. We need to understand that we cannot be spiritual Switzerlands, remaining neutral when a brother is in trouble, and it doesn't matter if the trouble is of his own making. Because, listen, love does not stand on the other side and do nothing. Love doesn't do that. Love always does something. And love, and here's the glory of it, does something for people who don't deserve it. That's what Edom didn't understand. Sometimes that's what we don't understand. They committed violence. Secondly, they rejoiced at their brother's distress. It wasn't that they just stood back and did nothing. They were delighted by what happened to their brother. And then verse 14, they even assisted the enemy. They weren't their brother's keeper, but they were sure their brother's killer, or at least impeding their progress so that the enemy could kill them. In verse 15, they ignored what was coming to them. I mean, verse 15 is the opposite of the golden rule. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Pharaoh said, you take all of those Hebrew boy babies and you throw them into the sea. Into the water. You kill them. You remember how Pharaoh's army ended up? Horse and rider. Drowned in the sea. There were some fellows there in Persia who had the green-eyed monster, and they conspired against Daniel. And they got him thrown in the lion's den. Remember what happened to them? They ended up thrown in the lion's den. We're to do to others as we would have them do to us. And when we fail in that, God will see that it's done to us as we wanted it done to them. Esau, Edom, did not love his brother, Jacob, Judah. And there is no stronger polemic in the prophets against the terribleness of not loving your brother, I don't think, than the prophet Obadiah. Now, let me try to make some application of all this. And to do so, go to Matthew chapter 5. I'm just going to make maybe one point out of Matthew chapter 5, but I want to pull in a couple of verses here. And when you get to Matthew 5, put your finger there and turn to 1 John chapter 4. There is a definition of love in 1 John 4 we want to get on the table before I go back to Matthew 5. 1 John chapter 4, verse 10. John says, herein is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and gave His Son to be a propitiation for us. John says, this is not what love is like. He doesn't say, this is not what love does. He says, this is what love is. He's giving us the essence of love. And he says, love does two things. Love takes the first step, and love takes the blame. Verse 19, we love Him because He first loved us. God revealed His love to us, and our response is to be love. I mean, that's what religion is, right? Religion is revelation, God's disclosure, and then our response to His revelation. Revelation always demands a response. And the God of love, who has disclosed Himself to be love, expects a loving response from us. But He took the first step. And He took the blame. That's what the word propitiation boils down to. Now, I understand propitiation is talking about appeasement and such, but on a practical level, propitiation means you are willing to take the blame when you're not to blame. Now, with that in mind, turn back to Matthew 5. I think Matthew 5, verse 20, is one of the most important verses, if not in Matthew, in all of the New Testament, but certainly in the Gospel of Matthew. In verse 20, Christ says, for I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now, what does that mean? Except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. They fasted twice a week. So does that mean we have to fast three times or more for our righteousness to exceed theirs? No, that's not what that means. They were legalists. They were just going through the motions. They were just checking off a list of do's and don'ts. That was their religion. What Christ calls us to is love. We were talking 1 Corinthians 13 this morning. Without love, I mean, we're nothing. And there is about love a superabundancy that goes above and beyond, that does more than is expected, that does what nobody can demand upon or insist. Christ says, go the second mile. The Romans could make you go 1 mile. And if you were impressed into duty by a Roman soldier, you had to carry his luggage for a mile. At the end of that mile, you could set that suitcase down and walk off, and he couldn't do any more about it. He couldn't make you go a second mile. Christ says love goes the second mile, and we're not really on the path of love until we're on the second mile. The first mile is the path of duty, the path of the law, the legalist path. The second mile is the path of grace, going above and beyond. And when Christ says our righteousness must exceed, must go above and beyond that of the scribes and Pharisees, He's calling us to act by love. Now let me give you an example of what He's talking about. Look at verse 23 and 24, Matthew chapter 5. Verse 23, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and you remember that your brother has aught against you, leave there your gift before the altar and go thy way. Be thou reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Christ is saying there is something more important than going to church. I mean, isn't that what He's saying here? You're on your way to church. You're on your way to offer your sacrifice. And you remember your brother's upset with you about something. And Christ doesn't discuss whether it's your fault or not. He says, you just remember your brother's upset with you. And he says, before you go to church, you stop where you are, you drop what you're doing, and you go find your brother and be reconciled to your brother. Now, that's what Christ said. But that's not often what's done. Because, you see, it's not our fault. I mean, if my brother's upset with me, it's not my fault. He's the one to blame. He misunderstood. He's twisted things out of proportion. He's made a mountain out of a molehill. He has no right to be upset. If anybody should go and try to patch things up, he knows what he's done. He knows where to find me. He needs to come to me. That's the way we often think, isn't it? That's not love. I want to tell you something, and you can check me out on this, and I don't think anyone's going to prove me wrong. Preachers all the time tell people to love God. Did you know Jesus never commanded his disciples to love God? Now, he answered a question in Matthew 22, what's the greatest commandment of the law? Love God, love your neighbor. But there is no passage that I found where Jesus commanded his disciples to love God. But over and over and over, he commanded his disciples to love one another. Because it's in loving one another that we love God. It's because in loving our brother, loving our neighbor, loving our fellow, that we demonstrate our love for God. You doubt that? Go to Matthew chapter 25. At the judgment, Christ separates the sheep from the goats. He turns to the sheep and says, you get to come into heaven because you did this, 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 this to me. They said, we're not sure what you're talking about. We don't ever remember having run into you, Lord. Christ says, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And please don't take a Pharisaic interpretation of that. As you did it unto one of the least of these, my brethren. Christ points out in Matthew that the only backs the Pharisees scratched were those who scratched their backs. He calls for men, his men, to love their enemies. And the least of these, my brethren, in the Gospel of Matthew includes everybody. Not just good Christians. As you did it to them, you've done it to me. Love takes the first step. If you know someone who's upset with you tonight, if you're going to act lovingly when you leave here, you're going to get a hold of them. And having gotten a hold of them, you're going to be willing to take the blame even if you don't think you're to blame. That's what propitiation does. Propitiation is the willingness to take the blame when you're not to blame. That's what Christ did. And he calls us to follow him in that, doesn't he? I'm telling you, there is nothing harder than love. Anybody who soft soaps love doesn't understand how hard it is to be thought the wrongdoer when you're not the wrongdoer, but you're willing to be thought the wrongdoer because of brotherliness. Because of brotherliness, because of reconciliation, because of having that relationship restored. Christ says that's so important. That before you offer your sacrifice, you go take care of brotherliness, and then you come back and finish offering your sacrifice. And that's a righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. They'd never do anything like that. But in the kingdom, that's what people do. And Obadiah helps us to understand how God views it when we don't love our brother. Now tomorrow night, Lord willing, I'm going to talk about a prophet who hated his enemy. We'll talk about Jonah tomorrow night. But let me thank you for your kind attention this evening. In the first three chapters of Hosea, God tells Hosea to do what no self-respecting prophet would ever do. He says, Hosea, I want you to go out and marry a whore. And I'll talk with you about what the commentators say about that. I don't think Hosea married a woman and then after the marriage she became a whore. I think she was a whore at the time they married, because God says, that's what I got when I got Israel. And Hosea goes out and marries her, just like God told him to. They have three kids. I'm not so sure that the latter two were his. The first one was. I'm not so sure about the latter two. She may have already been sleeping around. But after the birth of the third one, she takes off. And she goes down so far that she ends up a slave. She's lost her freedom. She's lost her dignity. She's lost all self-respect. And you know what God tells Hosea to do? He says, Hosea, you go and find her. You take the first step. You go find her and you pay whatever it takes to get her back. And Hosea scrapes together all the money he's got. Then he's got to get some grain on top of that. But he goes and buys her back with a broken heart. And that's a picture of what God's done with us. And that's a picture of what love is. And that's a picture of what we're called to do. There's a God who sent His Son to die for you. And if you've not been washed in the blood, the blood is there, forgiveness is there, and all that awaits is your response to God's revelation of the love that He's shown. If there's anyone here tonight who needs to respond to the Savior's invitation to come unto me, we invite you to come now while together we stand and while we sing.
All through His